This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell, who joins us for the first time since she was elected as the people's lawyer. AG Campbell, it's good to have you today.
It's great to be on.
So lots of important stuff to talk about, but I got to get to the serious stuff first. Are you team snow or not? Are you looking forward to what's likely to come tonight and tomorrow, or would you just as soon not have it around?
I don't mind snow, but it is nice when it comes and goes quickly.
So team short-term snow, I am down for that, yes.
I love team short-term snow. I do like the four seasons, and it seems like we're moving towards three.
Yes, yes, fair enough. Well, as they say with New England, if you don't like the weather, just wait. All right, and one more fun one, because we've been really curious about this one. What's the song you can't get out of your head right now?
Oh, I would say anything from Beyonce's Renaissance album, but Cozy is one of my favorites.
Nice. All right. I'm sure those were the two things you were expecting us to talk about first, right? Beyonce and snow.
Things Beyonce.
That's right. So let's jump into some serious stuff here. I want to do a quick touch on the news of the day. The Boston Globe reported recently that four defendants convicted of drug charges based on tests done at the now closed state-run Hinton Drug Lab, that's JP. They want new trials because they're saying that new documents from the Inspector General's office, and for the record, those were released by a Middlesex Superior Court judge, show that the employee misconduct was deeper than originally claimed. And it essentially, they're accusing state officials of hiding that fact. And swept up in that are accusations of your two predecessors as attorney general. So now Governor Maura Healey, as well as Martha Coakley. What is your role as the new attorney general in this going forward? And how do you deal with, how are you required to deal with any accusations that might be being made by defendants' lawyers of previous attorneys general?
Well, one, I've been stressing to the team, and it's a large one in the office, that of the values that we will have in the office, transparency and justice will be at the top of the list. And so in the context of the Hinton case, I'm reviewing a lot of material still related to that, waiting on some possible more guidance from the courts. And once I have an opportunity with my team to review all that information, we will then make a recommendation and we'll make that public once that decision has been made. And we will be transparent about how we got to that decision. I will just add, the goal will be hopefully to resolve it in such a way that the next attorney general doesn't have to continue to deal with this Hinton scandal going forward.
So you'd really like to get this put to bed once and for all during your time as attorney general?
That's the hope and desire of not just me, the team, and to move forward. So the next attorney general doesn't have to do that. And obviously, I've only been on the job a little over a month, and so need some time to review a lot of materials before making that decision thoughtfully and with those core values in mind.
All right, let's step back to the office and what your aspirations are for the role. Of course, during the campaign, you were asked that a million times. That's part of a campaign, but now you're in it, and you've said a few times in interviews over the last couple of weeks, tons of work, meeting with people, getting the background, collecting information before you come out with statements, et cetera. It's a huge job. You have a lot of priorities. Sort of the two or three priorities that you hope and want to be defining of your term as attorney general. And we'll skip possible second and third terms. We'll just stay with a one term here.
One is looking at everything related to economics. I think most folks know the traditional role and way in which the AG is viewed is keep our folks safe. As the chief law enforcement office and officer, I have the unique responsibility, of course, of enforcing our laws and protecting our residents. I also know that as we take on those safety issues and gun enforcement and gun violence, there are folks who are struggling in Massachusetts, struggling to live here. And so the office does a lot to put money back into the pockets of workers and of residents, taking on wage theft, which we've already dealt with some cases there, scams, aggressive debt collection practices, and there's more to do in the housing context. So I want to be known for working with a team that really delivers economic opportunity for our residents, including working on things that might close the racial wealth gap. And then, of course, keeping our people safe. And that means not only addressing gun violence and taking on gun enforcement and ghost guns, but taking on reproductive justice and making sure our folks are protected in every sense of the word. And reproductive justice right now is one of the top issues. Just launched a job description to create a reproductive justice unit. And as we're seeing things in Texas and other places try to roll back those rights, we in Massachusetts have an opportunity to lead and really to be at the forefront of those issues.
Since you ended those priorities with reproductive rights, I'll stay there with you for a minute. I have a couple of questions. You're talking about continuing to protect those rights. There is a new hotline to provide free legal advice and information about reproductive services in the Commonwealth, 833-399-6301 is that phone number. Since you launched it, how has it been going? Do you know how many calls you've gotten? Generally, what kinds of questions are coming in on that line? What can you tell us?
We're tracking it, but we're actually working with some external, incredible organizations that are helping us maintain it. It's a true partnership with Reproductive Equity Now, along with several law firms in the Boston area, the Women's Bar Foundation, and others. And so it's a little early. We just launched this in my first week in the office. But we are actively encouraging folks to call that number, and not just patients, also providers. Any questions you have related to access to services, your legal rights here in Massachusetts, this is a useful hotline. And for folks who are coming into Massachusetts, given what we're seeing in other states, it's also an opportunity for them to call this free confidential hotline to make sure that they know what their rights are and that we are not only progressive in our stances on these issues, but we really are at the forefront and want to continue to be that leader.
So I'm really intrigued about the balance of this confidentiality of the hotline, A.G. Campbell, and both your emphasis on transparency with this, you know, with the public services provided by the AG's office, and the fact that I have to believe other states and policymakers will be watching, right? We are at the front end of all the different ways that state governments, local governments around the country are going to respond to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And I'm sure there will be those who will want to know what you're hearing, what you're learning, what the patterns are coming out of a hotline like this. How do you strike that balance between the individual privacy of the people calling and the transparency that you value and the data that could be critically informative that comes out of that?
Right. And it's a careful balance. And we're going to first make sure we're prioritizing the privacy of folks, which is critically important, not only for this hotline, but as we take on crisis pregnancy centers that are putting out misinformation around what services they offer and pretending as if they offer reproductive or abortion services when they really don't. The privacy issues are major. So first and foremost, we will protect anyone who calls this line. We already have enough data, right? We didn't need this hotline to get data, or I would say information from folks as to why this right is so critically important. It's not just about access to critical reproductive healthcare services. It's about, when you say reproductive justice, how one chooses to parent, how one chooses to raise their children, that whole process and determination that an individual or family makes, we want to protect. And it's critically important. We know that voters care deeply about these issues. And I think when they saw that Dobbs decision, they realized we might have taken some of these rights for granted, and that we have to really show up every single day fighting for rights that people fought for decades ago. And Massachusetts will do just that. It's also a national issue we are leading on. I'm actively working with AGs all across the country, working to address what we're seeing in Texas, joining a coalition of states who filed a brief in that case to make sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can we clarify for listeners, when you say Texas, I'm assuming that you're talking about the case before the Supreme Court seeking to create an injunction for an FDA drug that was approved back in 2000 for use as for medical abortions. Am I correct?
That is correct. And it's one that we're watching closely, because this is a drug that has been proven by the FDA to be safe for years, and one medication that folks use to access these critical healthcare services. So we are not only fighting here in Massachusetts to protect this right, but we're fighting nationally with other AGs to take on Texas and anyone who would stand in the way of access to these critical healthcare services.
I want to pick up on one other thread on this before we move on. You talked about crisis pregnancy centers, and I want to know, from an AG's office's perspective, Is it the approach of the office to treat the entire category of crisis pregnancy centers as problematic? Or is it the approach of the AG's office to go center by center in your policy and legal approach? Do you understand my question?
I do. And based on what the office has seen, and this work started even before I got there, so give incredible credit to my predecessor, as well as, of course, folks in the office. It was really not just one, but some that were putting out this misinformation. And so the office put out an advisory on this to make sure people are aware of what they were actually getting themselves into. But it's also an opportunity for us to remain vigilant on these centers that purport to offer reproductive healthcare services, but do it in such a way that it almost off, you know, it sends misinformation to folks. And so we have an opportunity to protect our folks as they seek these services in a climate that is not very friendly. And so we want to make sure that in Massachusetts, we continue to lead on these issues as well.
We're talking with Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell. I want to pepper in a couple of questions from listeners that touch on things you've already brought up. And you just talked about misinformation, so I think I'll start there. And for listeners, you can become part of our texting group by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That information is also on our About page if you want to become part of the texting group. So we had on misinformation, Lori of Roslindale, who sent you a hello as well, asks in part, how do you know when nasty social media posts cross the line from aggravating to a violation of civil rights as delineated in the Massachusetts civil rights laws?
That's a great question. And hi, Lori from Roslindale, who I know. You know, this connects to actually a priority, not just about misinformation, but one set of priorities that would be important to the office. You know, I mentioned economics, I mentioned protecting our residents in terms of gun violence and reproductive justice and the environment, but the well-being of our kids. So as we talk about social media companies and misinformation, which is coming up, and also the mental health concerns that we are seeing for young people as they interact with these platforms, it's something the office is looking into and I think should absolutely be prioritized. There are some ongoing matters that I hope will be prioritized in such a way that we begin to take on these issues in a serious way, in a coordinated way, not only with the AG's office, but higher ed institutions, other folks in our federal delegation and state delegation. So the misinformation, I think, connects not only with social media companies in the traditional way you think about them, but also the well-being of our youth and mental health is a major set of issues the office will take on.
So you made a reference to, I think what you were referring to was a case that's before the U.S. Supreme Court right now about social media companies and whether or not they have responsibility as publishers for the, you know, the veracity, basically, of the content. First, just very briefly, was that the reference you were making?
Somewhat. Yes, we're watching that case closely. But in the office, the great thing about the Attorney General's office is we have tools to proactively and affirmatively go after things. And so as we see complaints from constituents or parents or guardians or caregivers complaining about what they're seeing on social media companies, or not only misinformation, but threats or attacks or the well-being of their children they're concerned with, this is an opportunity for the office to look at social media companies and to prioritize taking on these cases. And the Supreme Court decision, when it happens, will inform our approach and the legal theories we take it on.
So the second question there, and it was on our mind, and we also got a question from Adam of Swampscott about the state AG's office's level of influence on national topics, right? We've referenced here in our conversation already two Supreme Court cases that are going to be heard this year. We know that your predecessor, now Governor Maura Healey, had, I think one could arguably say, a strong emphasis on being engaged in national policy discussions. Do you see the office filing lots of amicus briefs on Supreme Court cases, getting deeply involved at the Supreme Court level and the congressional level on policy issues that, let's say, are macro to Massachusetts's micro, if you will?
I think we have to strike a balance. One thing I did hear as I crisscrossed the state is, yes, folks want us to pay attention to some national issues, of course, and protect us, but they don't want us to forget the issues we have to deal with here at home. And so economics is a major opportunity for us, not only to put money back into the pockets of workers through a whole host of tools in the office, but to also lead on that nationally. Who's really taking that on? I want to work with other AGs who are looking to do that, because the AG's office is not just the top cop or chief law enforcement officer. We're also a policy shop. But the other places that we want to make sure we're showing up on is gun enforcement. There are folks actively working to repeal or to eliminate our common sense gun laws here in Massachusetts. We have an opportunity to protect them while showing up nationally to make sure we're not going backwards in this space.
So how?
In addition to that,
let me stop you there, please, AG Campbell, and lay out for us how. We have an opportunity to protect, and again, by the way, third Supreme Court case in New York that rolled back some of the provisions in Massachusetts law about sort of shall versus will grant authorization for the use of handguns. So what's the blueprint for protecting the laws we have in place?
I'll focus on guns. So right now, since I've been in office, we've already filed a responsive briefs and amicus briefs to protect our assault weapons ban and other safety measures we have here against folks who think they should be able to carry a weapon of any type in Massachusetts. So we're proactively in our courts here. Nationally, we can show up with other AGs to file amicus briefs to protect our gun rights. The other piece we can do here locally is establish a unit. I promised to establish a gun enforcement unit to protect and enforce our gun laws here in Massachusetts and to also take on community violence. So that's just a few quick ways in which we can work locally and nationally to take on a major issue. The same for reproductive justice. And lastly, I will say the same in the context of police accountability and criminal legal reform, which I also want to continue to be a leader on major issues that our office can work on both locally and nationally.
So you've talked about guns and gun violence and community violence, and I want to stay on the gun as gun piece for a second here longer. You're talking about, you know, there are a group of sort of working groups or task forces that you're looking at putting together, one in this area. I want to understand how it would play out in something like Littleton, right? So Boston Globe reporting about a large group of gun vendors in a single location, Littleton, Massachusetts. That grew from 3 to at least 80 in 8 years. It raises questions about the kinds of loopholes and loose interpretations in our current gun bills that can allow for the purchase and sale of pieces of weaponry, for example, that can be reassembled into guns that otherwise might not be allowed to be bought and sold in the Commonwealth. A task force like what you want to put together, how does it go address something like Littleton as an example explicitly?
Enforcement, enforcement, enforcement. That's what I heard from so many folks, including folks who used to work in the AG's office and who thought the office could do more to enforce our gun laws. So that means if we establish a unit in the office, which we will do, assigning actual lawyers and staff where their sole responsibility is to work with municipalities, to work with local law enforcement to enforce our gun laws. Some may have the resources and human capital to do that. Others may not. We can provide assistance there. Best practices and sharing of information, we can do that as well, particularly post the Bruin Supreme Court case. In addition to that, we can take on bad actors. In the context of ghost guns right now, we're looking at who was buying illegal parts and putting them together to sell illegal guns to folks who shouldn't have them. So there's a lot this unit can do. But in addition to the traditional way you think about gun enforcement, community violence also has to be a part of this unit's focus.
So let's go there now. And what is the difference between, so, you know, and it's important to hear this emphasis on we can enforce our current laws better than we have. And when you put people in place who that's their sole job, they can do that in a different way. How do you then bridge to the community violence piece of this, which we've really strived here on Radio Boston to treat as a very nuanced conversation that can be related to but is not synonymous with the purchase and sale of guns?
That's right. We often talk about gun enforcement just in that context and enforce our gun laws to keep them out of the hands of bad folks or to make sure inspections are happening, et cetera. I'm hearing from district attorneys, from folks on the ground, including law enforcement, is the prevalence of guns in our municipalities, particularly our gateway communities, is extraordinary. and many of them are ghost guns. I also heard it from our U.S. attorney, illegal guns on our streets, some that you cannot trace. That's the definition of a ghost gun. So there is an opportunity to really take that on. But at the same time, people are dying. I live in Mattapan in Boston. We had the 13-year-old that was shot and killed. We just had a young lady that was killed in Dorchester. And of course, more folks this weekend. And this is happening in Holyoke and other places as well. How can the same unit be addressing in trauma measures that reduce violence, investing in organizations that get guns off the street and that are actively breaking cycles of violence, including youth-based organizations? There's a role for this unit and this office to play. And to bridge those conversations, they go hand in hand.
It's the bridging. And I guess in talking with you, A.G. Campbell, given your history, your personal stories, the way you've approached your leadership back since Boston City Council, do you think you, as you, in the Attorney General's role, can create a goodwill connection and level of collaboration between a unit like that and all the kinds of on-the-ground grown-ups and schools and nonprofits, et cetera, that interface with kids both experiencing and perpetrating community violence in a way that is different? Do you understand my question?
I do. And the short answer is yes. But it's not just me. You know, I represent an organization of nearly 600 people, lawyers and staff who work hard every day. We can do it. These are folks who are dedicated to the work, have the expertise and the passion. And so how do we become that convener? How do we also move forward with some action, including on this unit and other things we promised? We can do that. And I think when we do, we will do it in such a way that it brings together stakeholders that maybe aren't always in the room together. And why the Office of Attorney General can do it, it has the credibility, the integrity, which we will maintain, and a standard of excellence in terms of getting things done that I want to continue and want to grow, that we can do it. And so I think we are best positioned, given the authority of the office to do it, given the credibility and integrity of the office. And so now we have an opportunity to do a lot. We don't want to waste any time. And so we'll be thoughtful, but we won't waste time in taking on these critical issues.
All right. A healthy start there, although so much more to talk about with you, Attorney General Andrea Campbell. We promised your team we'd get you out on time for your next meeting. I both want to thank you, and we all had a craving for Cozy from Beyonce after you mentioned it, so we'll go out on that. Attorney General Andrea Campbell, will you come back and join us again soon, please?
Absolutely, especially if you keep playing Beyonce.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Roxbury Community College, it's turning 50, and it's crossing the half-century mark at a really tricky moment for its mission and for higher education as an industry. So listen, the community college was founded to serve students of color and achieved through the activism of Black residents in the late 1960s after a successful fight to stop a highway from cutting through the middle of the neighborhood. Now, you fast forward to today, 50 years later, they're naming pioneers from those first 50 years, even as the institution faces headwinds in enrollment, money, the higher ed industry in general. So we wanted to ask, who are we celebrating and what does it mean for the next 50 years? Here with us in Studio 2, Interim President Jackie Jenkins Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. And I do want to start with the celebratory part, right?
Yes.
Because you wanted 50 pioneers. You picked the community of Roxbury as one, which we've just sort of established why, right? Given that history. But you used this really participatory process to pick the other 49.
Yes, we did.
So what kinds of people did the community want you to celebrate as pioneers? And what did you learn from that process?
Oh, it's an exciting, exciting group of people. First of all, we had a committee of dedicated, you know, members of the Board of Trustees and community members who selected from over 80-plus nominations, some, and then when you add the individuals, because several families were nominated, families who had such influence in Roxbury.
For example?
Like the Haynes family, Reverend Michael Haynes and his brothers and family. The Elam family was nominated as a family because they had so, you know, such an influence in this community. Both Mel King and Joyce King were nominated. Mel King, of course, we know of his amazing leadership in Boston.
And you chose him, former state representative, local advocate, first Black candidate in the final round to run for mayor of Boston.
Mayor of Boston. But many people do not know that his wife, Joyce, was an amazing leader. She chaired the Board of Trustees of Roxbury Community College in the early days. So they got nominated individually. And so it's really thrilling to have both of them selected by the committee. We also have people who've been faculty members at the college for the group that started the social sciences department was nominated as a group, two faculty members. We have current faculty members, one of whom is an RCC alum who graduated from RCC, went on to law school, and is now teaching. Nanette. So we're just really thrilled with the group of the representative and diverse group, artists from the community. So it's a wonderful group of people that are being recognized.
So we're talking with Jackie Jenkins Scott, who's the interim president of Roxbury Community College in its 50th year here, to the extent that history teaches about us about what's important in the future.
Yeah.
What did you learn from the heroes, the pioneers that were nominated in the 50 you chose? And you named a few there also, Sarah Ann Shaw, Ray Hammond. There's a number of others. Sarah Ann Shaw I just want to shout her out because the first Black television journalist in Greater Boston. What did you learn the college has to do and who it needs to help produce in the next 50 years?
You know, it's... it was very inspiring because we learned that persistence and resilience and passion and courage are all elements that got this institution started. And guess what? Those are all the attributes that are needed today.
So is that a good thing or is that a discouraging thing because the same things we needed 50 years ago are the things we need today? Or is it because universally, that's what passionate leadership is.
The arc of justice. We've heard that so often bends towards justice, but we have to make it bend, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not discouraged by that because we look at, you know, the progress that has been made and we know that the road is not, it's not always easy. I was talking recently about the fact that this school is here only because the community insisted on it. The powers that be back in the late 60s and early 70s wanted the school to be part of another college and located in Dorchester. Then they wanted it merged with another community college, Mass Bay originally, and then to be merged, you know, back in the early 80s with another community college. So the community actually said, no, we won't have it. We want this institution. And, when I came on just a little over a year ago as interim president, I talked to a lot of people. And the universal thing that I heard was a love of this institution. I could not find one person who does not want this institution to thrive.
So I want to bring that context in now. We're speaking with President Jackie Jenkins Scott of Roxbury Community College. You came in after arguably a couple of decades of some pretty serious challenge for the institution.
Yes.
You know, accusations of financial mismanagement. The nursing school lost its accreditation, got its accreditation
back. Yes. Perseverance.
19 and 20. Controversies over things like the use of the Reggie Lewis Center, which a set of recommendations just came out about sort of baking in community input to ensure quality access to that center. So,
absolutely.
I mean, you came in eyes wide open
on
all of that.
Well, you know, you always find out a few things that you didn't know.
What surprised you then coming in?
Well, I think two things surprised me. Despite it all, this college has people who have, some people have worked, I think you're going to even talk to Nurse Hines, who's been there 40 years.
We did, and she's a pioneer, right?
Yes,
she's one of the pioneers.
She's one of the pioneers.
Yeah.
So despite it all, we are here and there is a love. And there was, you know, one of the things that surprised me most was the quality of the programs and the quality of the teaching, the quality of the people who there who love the students. They love this community and they want this community to thrive. So that's a lot to build on.
So let's talk about those challenges then. And again, from a stewardship perspective. So you have now said, listen, we're 50 mm-hmm. years in. This organization exists, this community college exists because the community of color yes. in Roxbury fought for it to exist.
Absolutely.
And for it to educate students of color yes. in Boston.
Absolutely.
We've acknowledged the financial challenges and the management challenges, et cetera. We're looking ahead now in mm-hmm. an industry that is existentially challenged,
yes.
especially
Absolutely.
Small colleges. I mean, you led
WELOC.
Right.
Yes.
WELOC, which you left in 2016, yes. is now merged with yes. Boston University, yes. who holds the license for WBUR.
Yes.
So you've seen what can survive and what can't.
Yes.
What has to happen in the next 5 to 10?
Sure.
Money-wise, policy-wise, recruitment-wise, enrollment's
All
down.
All of those, yeah.
Right?
Enrollment's up.
Back up.
We're modest improvements. You just named some of the things. There are things that we have to fix in the college. You know, when I talk about our situation, some of it is long-term systemic having to fight for this institution. Some of it is self-inflicted wounds, let's be honest. And so, like any institution, you have to constantly be growing and changing. And one of the things that we have talked about this last, you know, year or so that we've been here is what is a high-performing institution? We have to be a high-performing institution. And we have to know what that is. And so to this college community, they welcomed bringing in some views, some outsiders to look at our programs, to look at our systems, to look at our operations, to look at our people, to look at how we're structured. We have to do all of that. At the same time, we have to be very high performing. So you mentioned the Pathway Forward. Report,
on the Reggie Lewis Center.
On the Reggie
yep.
Lewis. That was one of those exercises, and we did the same thing in HR. We did the same thing in IT. We did the same thing in enrollment. So part of an institution's constant growth is to constantly be looking at itself. And that's not a bad thing. That's an important thing to do, and we're doing that. So that's there, but we also have to kind of change. We have to understand what's happening in higher education.
Yeah.
We're a part of that. We're very actively involved with the Mass Community College Association, and they're looking at all of the issues facing community colleges. You know, as you know, there are 15 in Massachusetts. All of our colleges have had decreasing enrollment. Fortunately,
took huge hits from COVID.
It took huge, huge hits from COVID. We're all rebounding. And fortunately, we have, new governor who cares deeply about higher education, who cares deeply about community colleges. And so we have an opportunity now, not just for Roxbury Community College, but for all of the community colleges to really...
Let's stay there. Yeah. So I really appreciate you bringing that up because... So we have a governor in Maura Healey who has said, I want community college for people over the age of 25 and older
yes.
to be free.
Yes.
We also have a state legislature that has said maybe more.
Yes.
Maybe we should have it be free for everybody.
Yes.
What would it mean in order, right, to students at Roxbury Community College and to the survival of the institution
yes.
to have either of those policies funded and enacted in the Commonwealth?
Funded at a level that supports them. I mean, you know, this is a huge investment that I'm sure over this next short period of time, we have an opportunity to really understand, A, what the real costs are to make those both of those happen. The governor's Reconnect program, it looks really, really important. It's an important opportunity for RCC because we have people in our community. We want them at that age, to be able to participate in...
Older 20s.
It's 25 and over to be able to participate in both, four-credit programming, but we have some extraordinary programs that can get them good, high-paying jobs. We just announced one last week with the City of Boston, a collaboration with the City of Boston around clean building and smart building programming. So this will be opportunities for people to have access to both programming and higher education that's affordable. And hopefully that will lead to jobs that will keep them in their community, keep them in Roxbury.
And the financial model for RCC right now, mm-hmm. do you feel like the mix of what you're getting from government funding, what you're able to fundraise, what your mm-hmm. tuition is, students' mm-hmm. ability to pay tuition, mm-hmm. enrollment, which is up yes. from last year, but nobody's really recovered from COVID
no,
yet.
No, it's modest growth. We are appreciating every...
We're celebrating the wins where
we've
got
them. We're celebrating the wins.
Do you think the model, the financial model works?
Well, you know, the financial model of higher education is under scrutiny and has been for a very long time. What we know, and I hear it from parents quite often, from parents who have graduated students from four-year colleges who say, you know, if we had it to do it over again, we probably should have thought about starting at a community college.
Which is significantly cheaper for those first 2 years of
cheaper.
Credit.
Absolutely. And that's something, one of our hopes from the 50th anniversary year is we get to tell that story more, that people can understand what's available. The facilities at Roxbury Community College are terrific. They are, I hate to say this, and but it's absolutely true. I was a college president for 12 years. Our science labs are state of the art. They are terrific. And so we want to get that story out. And part of the 50th anniversary year gives us that opportunity, and we're excited about that.
So I have to ask you, you're an interim now.
I'm an interim.
Do you want the job?
I am an interim, and I am loving it. One of the hopes and our aspirations for this next period of time is that, you know, people need to understand that Roxbury Community College is a phenomenal institution, and we're going to have a line of people waiting to apply for the permanent president. And we're going to have a permanent president who will come in and really love this institution the way the community loves it and have the talents and skills to take it to the next level. So we're positioned for the next 50 years.
Sounds like you love it.
I love it. It's an incredible institution. And you know what? It is, it's a privilege to stand on the shoulders of the people who fought for this institution. That's kind of the obligation that I think we all have these days. When you have this kind of legacy and you have this kind of history and we have this need that's ahead of us, the need hasn't gone. The need hasn't been fulfilled. So we have an obligation to do our work. It's our turn to pave the way for the next generation, and that's exciting.
Jackie Jenkins-Scott of Roxbury Community College, thank you so much for joining us. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you.
Boston took center stage in Utah this last weekend at Sunday's NBA All-Star Game.
I don't think there's much suspense. An all-time record, most points scored ever. The Kobe Bryant Trophy for the Kia MVP, Jason Tatum.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver there presenting Celtics superstar Jason Tatum with the All-Star Game MVP trophy. Tatum scored 55 points in the game. That breaks Anthony Davis's record of 52 set in 2017. And at least as important, if not more importantly, the Celtics get back to the regular season action tomorrow night as the team prepares to make a final push to try to lock in the number one seed for the playoffs. And with a coach permanently in tow now. So there's a lot to talk about. And we want to discuss it all with our expert panel. First up, Jonathan Marshall, sports reporter for WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Hello, guys. How's it going?
It's great to have you. Chris, how is it going? Because WBUR's Chris Siderick also with us.
Oh, we are feeling good heading into that home stretch. Let's go, C's.
All right. So I do want to start with Jason Tatum sort of hitting the next level of NBA stardom, arguably, with this performance on Sunday night. Jonathan, your takeaways from the All-Star game?
Well, I mean, look, the conversation surrounding the All-Star game is much like how I feel. Kudos to Jason Tatum, but not a lot of defense being played in the moments you would want to see it. Definitely a glorified shoot around in practice, if I'm being honest. Not what I would like to see from the stars of the NBA, but
kind of for people who don't watch it, kind of an unwritten rule that you get to just kind of shoot away.
Yeah, but at a certain point in the game, you expect to see these competitors compete against each other. I mean, that's what I'm used to seeing growing up as a basketball fan, but things have changed, obviously. But it's all, I think there's something to say about Jason Tatum wanting that stage and taking advantage of the moment. I think early on you knew, you can tell when a guy is going for it, and he went for it. He knows that in the grand scheme of things, having an All-Star MVP isn't the end-all be-all, but it's one of those things that the greats have, the LeBrons, the Steph Curry. So in addition to wanting to win a championship, having an All-Star MVP looks good on the resume. So this is just the first step, and I'm sure he's aiming for that Finals MVP next as well.
So that there was another Celtics person who figured in huge, right? And that is Joe Mazzulla, who just before heading into the All-Star weekend, the Boston Celtics, okay, so backing up, he's been interim for less than a year now since the Boston Celtics suspended coach after 1 year, Ime Udoka, for the reporting has been an inappropriate sexual relationship with a staff member. And there's a lot of history there that we've covered on Radio Boston. But Chris Siderek, this move going into the All-Star break with less than 30 games left before the playoffs seemed like a pretty big deal in terms of locking in some stability. Is that the right read?
Yeah, and that's exactly what Celtics management and ownership has said the move was all about, is basically removing any uncertainty so that players can really kind of focus on the playoff push. I think Joe Mazzulla has done a pretty decent job this year. He stepped into what could have been a tough situation. He also inherited a very talented team. But, you know, anytime there is an off-court distraction like the Udoka suspension, I think you run the risk of kind of derailing the season. So he has kept things together, and I think it makes sense for the team to kind of make this a permanent move.
So,
point.
Jonathan, much ado, including in our own team meeting this morning, getting ready for the show today, about whether or not this is a moment where Mazzulla, as an inexperienced coach who—okay, so framing number one. This is a great coach who came into a super messy situation that easily could have collapsed, kept it together with talented players who were in need of their next level of maturity on the court, which they have achieved under his leadership. And this is a nod to a guy who's earned it right now. And then the other, you know, sort of argument is this is an exciting opportunity for a young black coach to get a chance to become great and isn't yet, but has a great team. And then there's a lot in the middle of that with an hour-long conversation we could sort of pull out. Where are you on that, Jonathan?
I think that Joe Mazzulla has done an amazing job given the situation. And being a young black coach and, you know, not seeing young black coaches in general getting these opportunities to see him step into a positive situation, which we don't see often, and taking advantage of it. And so I'm glad that he's been given this opportunity and he's being rewarded, because in any field of work, if a person steps in to take on a leadership role, first time in that role, not expecting, giving a day's notice, they're 33, 34, early 30s, mid 30s, so young, and they reach every marker and exceed every expectation, do they deserve the interim tag to be removed? Like, it's just a question of, do you believe in this person or do you not believe in this person? And so obviously Brad Stevens, the Boston Celtics, they believe in him, and he's shown that he has the ability to lead a locker room. It's not easy to win in professional sports and to win at a high level. And he's not only one with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. He's one with those guys sitting down, being hurt. He's one with the likes of Malcolm Brogdon, Derek White, Sam Hauser, Luke Kornet. And so what he's been able to do to keep these guys ready, no matter the situation, a lot has, you know, I mean, it's a great situation, but Mazzulla has shown the ability to maneuver and adjust giving no matter the situation. And so we got to give him credit. We have to.
So we're talking with Jonathan Marshall of WMUR and Chris Siderek from here at WBUR about this really critical kind of junction moment for the Boston Celtics coming out of the All-Star. Jason Tatum makes MVP. Joe Mazzulla is given the nod as the permanent coach. We've got, what, like a couple dozen games before we hit the playoffs. Big expectations for the Celtics. Chris, hopefully when one appoints a permanent coach, permanent lasts a while, right? So, you know, Joe Mazzulla could be in the role for a long time. What are players saying about this move?
So the players are pretty supportive. They've definitely spoken up and said that they have appreciated Joe Mazzulla's leadership and all of that. There was kind of an interesting comment from Jason Tatum over All-Star Weekend that I want to play, talking about his relationship with Ime Udoka, actually.
You know, I can't take away the relationship that me and him had and the impact that he had on me in that one season. You know, I love Coach K. I love Brad. I love Joe. I love all those guys, but, you know, just a different kind of relationship I had with Ime, and, you know, probably like my most favorite coach I've had. And that's not a knock on anybody. I got a great relationship with Joe.
And he went on to say some more great things about Joe Mazzulla, but clearly there was a special connection there with Udoka. I think part of it has to do with kind of where he was at in his career. We're talking about Jason Tatum, obviously the de facto leader of the Celtics. Basically, he has been kind of maturing. They made that deep finals run last year, and now are kind of looking to take it to that next level. Great column from Boston Globe's Chad Finn today, basically saying there's two kind of big question marks for Joe Mazzulla as this team gets ready for the playoffs. One is his use of timeouts. He tends to not call timeouts, which is kind of counter to everybody else's approach in the NBA. If you see the opposite team, you know, go on in a run or something, you would call a timeout, generally speaking, to kind of kill that momentum and try
kind
to
reset.
Change. Yeah, exactly. So, and that's something that Joe Mazzulla doesn't do. We'll see if that approach changes come playoff time when every single possession and every single basket matters. The other question is player management. Chad Finn points out that Jason Tatum, who we saw basically run out of gas last year, is now playing the second highest minutes per game in the league. He's got the fourth most minutes so far this season. So will they be able to manage his load and make sure that he stays fresh? I do think Tatum has matured himself as well and will kind of tackle the playoffs with a little bit of a different mindset now that he's kind of been there, done that. The one other question mark I would say Chad Finn did not have in his column is, will Mazzulla be able to make the adjustments in a seven-game series that are really the difference between regular season games and the playoffs? When you see the same team again and again and again, can you exploit mismatches? Can you find their weakness? Can you address things that they're doing by changing up what you're doing? That remains to be seen.
All right, Jonathan Marshall, in our last minute or so, what will you watch for over, let's say, even just like the next 10, 12 games for the Boston Celtics? There's a really high expectation that they not only get into the playoffs, but bring home a trophy.
Yeah, I think you make a finals run last year, a couple wins away from winning a championship. You know what the goal is, right? You've led the league atop the standings from the jump. And so the regular season is a chance to prove your dominance, take a hold of that number one seed, have home court advantage number one. I think that's what the rest of this season is about, right? Let's get
that number one seed.
Lock up home court advantage. And for me, it's a healthy, like I've said it before, two things that can get in the way of Boston right now when it comes to winning the East is themselves and their health. Right. We've seen this lineup. Marcus Smart has been out. Jalen is, you know, he's dealing with the facial fracture, and we've seen these guys miss time. And so can they get these guys healthy? Can they start to get that rhythm going together as a whole unit, seeing how these guys look together for this final stretch? And I think they'll be good to go. Honestly, that's what I'm looking at. Health. Can they keep these guys healthy? Can they get these guys ready for this playoff stretch? The playoffs is a grind. We're talking about June. If they're talking about a finals run, that's in June. We're in February now. So just understand. That is. That's a long run.
You're cutting out there, Jonathan, but I got my checklist and it is what I will watch. And you're making me tired just thinking about what they're going to have to go through. Jonathan Marshall there, WMUR in New Hampshire, WBUR's Chris Siderick on the line as well. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.